Thank you, sir. Thank you, committee members. Now we will move on into agenda paper 6. The committee received submissions about recognition cash received via an electronic transfer system as settlement of financial assets in the fact pattern of trade receivables with a customer. Submission asks whether an entity can derecognize a trade receivables and recognize the cash on the debt the cash transfer initiated by the customer rather than on the debt the cash transfer is settled. Paragraph 10 and 19 summarize our outreach performed, and paragraph 20 to 42 include our analysis of the matters. Based on our analysis, we conclude that applying a verse 9, the entity that recognized the trade receivables on the debt in which contractual right to the cash flow of the trade receivables expired and recognized the cash or another financial asset as a settlement of debt trade receivables on the same date. The entity would consider its particular facts and circumstances, including applicable law, regulations, and the characteristic of electronic transfer system in determining whether the contractual right to the cash flow from the trade receivables expire on the transfer settlement date earlier upon initiation of the cash transfer or any debt in between. I will now direct you to the questions 1 on the page 13 and ask whether you agree with our analysis regarding the applications of the requirement of IFRS standard. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sam. So, handing over to committee to see first whether you have any comments on the analysis. So, first is John.
So, I agree ultimately with where the analysis goes. There's just one aspect which I think is could be specific to a jurisdiction or to the terms of the receivable contract, which the terms of the receivable contract could potentially eliminate the right to receive cash from the counterparty at the time that payment is acknowledged. Depending on the jurisdiction, within some countries in my company, that can be the case, where the right to receive cash then becomes something different while in transit. It becomes a right to receive cash from an intermediary institution. But that doesn't change the fact that I don't have control over the cash until the settlement date. So when I looked at the wording ultimately in the agenda decision, I think in the final analysis, at the end, I'm comfortable with it because it talks about that there may be another financial asset that could come into play. And I think that makes sense. I just want to be careful that we wouldn't suggest that because perhaps the right to receive cash has been extinguished, therefore it's concluded that you have control over the cash, because I don't think those two necessarily logically follow. Otherwise, I agree with the analysis with that one stipulation.
Okay, thank you, John. Donna.
So I will echo John's comments. I do think that the questions in paragraph 36 are actually very well thought out and give the reader and any user of the IFRS or of the stock paper to really understand what we're trying to get at, is that the settlement feature and the settlement mechanism is not the deciding factor, but rather the rights of the financial asset and financial liability, or in this case, the debtor and the cash that you're going to be receiving. I agree with the assertion that is made by the staff in paragraph 37, in particular where we would expect an entity to typically de-recognize the trade receivable on transfer settlement date when the deposit has hit the bank account. I like the fact that we would expect an entity to typically de-recognize. So I think maybe to John's concern is that we're not saying you will, but we're saying you typically would expect. So in other words, giving it clear in my mind that you do take other facts and circumstances into consideration when considering whether derecognition has occurred. I do agree with paragraph 39. Where the staff put it in another way. The bank has no obligation to deliver cash to the entity for amounts that is not yet received and deposited with the bank in the entity's bank account. I think maybe I'm in agreement with that comment, but I think it might be a little bit too black and white, and something exactly because, like John is pointing out, there are some jurisdiction issues around the world that may be slightly different. For example, you know, I wouldn't know honestly, Watson, but I'm just assuming that there could be a bit of a concern there from some of the users. And then I do agree with paragraph, the staff's conclusion in paragraph 43A, relating to paragraph 3.2.1 of FS9, relating to a regular way purchase or the sale of an asset. You would, you know, what's and what? So my apologies. Regularly way purchase or sale of a financial asset are not applicable. So this is definitely not a trade date versus settlement date discussion. Absolutely, I'm in agreement with that assessment. So, yeah, so I'm in agreement with the staff's assessment. Thank you.
Thank you, Johnny. Jens?
Being nice, well-drafted paper, and I fully agree with the technical analysis.
Thank you, Jens. Carsten?
I too think that the staff analysis on this matter is really convincing, but I also do agree with the technical analysis and conclusions. However, I wonder whether the analysis could be more clear in one particular aspect. The analysis, I think, focuses very much on when the trade receivable would be derecognized and when the cash or another receivable would be recognized, which clearly makes sense to me. I was just wondering, you know, there is a subtle aspect here which I think may potentially be missing, which is the presentation of those assets. Now, my reading of the analysis is that, you know, if the trade receivable does not qualify for derecognition, you would continue to present a trade receivable. And if the trade receivable is derecognized, you would either present cash or you would present a receivable towards the bank. However, it seems that this is not explicit in the wording of the agenda decision, as the wording focuses on recognition and derecognition rather than presentation of the related assets. So I worry that the agenda decision might be read in a way that it essentially only talks about the timing of recognition and derecognition, but does not clearly say where those assets are presented in the balance sheet when they do not meet the definition of cash. In particular, I think that some might suggest that even if an entity does not yet meet the requirements for recognition of cash, the wording in the TED would not preclude an entity from presenting its receivable as a cash equivalent. The agenda decision appears to suggest that an entity, depending on its specific facts and circumstances, would present in its balance sheet either a trade receivable, cash, or receivable towards the bank. However, if it's a receivable rather than cash, then I think the wording in the tentative agenda decision is not entirely clear on where a receivable should be presented, and in particular, whether any receivable could meet the definition of a cash equivalent and thus potentially be presented as cash and cash equivalents. Personally, I have to say I struggle a bit with the idea that, you know, even if the criteria for recognition of cash are not yet met, that the entity might be able to present a receivable as a cash equivalent. However, I'm not sure the wording in the tentative agenda decision is sufficiently clear in this respect. So if that is what the staff thinks, and if the committee agrees with that thinking, then I would recommend to be clear in the tentative agenda decision that an entity does not present any receivable as a cash equivalent.
Okay. I've always thought about things far more simply than I think you are, because I thought that it would follow that you present things consistent with what you've recognised.
That's my view as well. I agree with that, but I just think the wording could be more clear in this regard, just to, if that's what we think.
Okay. I'm not sure what words I can pin to other than common sense is my only hesitation, even though I agree with you. But, like,
but common sense is not common.
Yeah, exactly. My most famous word is seriously, to which I would apply here. Lisa, I think you're next.
Yeah, thanks, Sue. I agree with the staff conclusion and analysis, and I think that it is very, very well written. I echo many of the points that Donna's already made, so I won't repeat those. I think my main comment I have is in regards to some wording in the tentative decision, so I'll just hold off and come in later on that point.
Okay. Okay, thanks, Lisa. Paul?
Yeah, thanks, Sue. I think the analysis here by the staff is spot on, including John's point that just because you conclude you are able to derecognize a receivable doesn't mean you've got cash. You might then have a receivable from another party, which conceptually could affect your ECL reserve, although I acknowledge that given the short period of time, that's probably not significant, but at least that would be part of the conceptual thought process. I think it's also relevant to note that the same analysis, I think, would apply to other circumstances where there are, I'll use air quotes, deposits in transit, whether it's checks in transit, credit card receipts in transit, other electronic transit mechanisms. I don't think the analysis would be limited to this specific fact pattern. I think the same thought process would apply to other circumstances where there is some kind of a transit process getting from the receivable to having cash on hand. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Renata, did you have anything you wanted to add?
No, I totally agree with the conclusion. So,
okay, thank you very much. Donna, you wanted to come back in?
Carson, just with respect to your question, are you concerned about the potential for manipulation in the sense that I've seen it in a due diligence once in a forensic where the debtor was basically derecognized and then cash was recognized, but in actual fact it turned out not to be cash but another debtor, for example. Is that where your concern is in the way the conclusion is written? I'm just trying to understand the particular concern that you have.
Well, my main concern is that, you know, if you're in a situation where you cannot yet recognize cash and therefore you either have a trade receivable or you have a receivable towards the bank, that an entity might consider that you still meet the definition of a cash equivalent, not cash, but of a cash equivalent.
Yeah.
And therefore that you know, somebody might say, well, actually, if I look at the definition of cash equivalent, it's not entirely clear whether that cash in transit that does not yet meet the definition of cash or the recognition criteria for cash, whether that might meet the definition of a cash equivalent. And I don't think that's what the words suggest, but I also worry a little bit that it's not entirely clear. And, you know, maybe we should be more clear in this respect if we think, you know, if we think that a receivable should not be presented as a cash equivalent or doesn't qualify as a cash equivalent.
But are we not then maybe extending the question a little bit? And I mean, I definitely understand where you're coming from because I've seen that in practice as well, is, you know, where you've got a very short-term debtor and you know, whoever I was chatting to was insistent that they would want to see that as cash equivalent. I mean, the only concern that I had there was it's just the significant credit risk that is exposed. So that's generally why a debtor by definition is not a cash equivalent, is because of the significant credit risk associated with the debtor. Is that not a way that it would naturally be caught out in practice, or do you think it's something that should be a little bit more definitive in the interpretation?
Well, I even wonder I've heard that argument as well about, you know, insignificant credit risk, but I don't really think it matters whether that credit risk is significant or insignificant. That's not part of the definition, I think, of those line items. And therefore, I just worry that we, you know, maybe should be, if we think it's not a cash equivalent, if there's cash in transit, maybe we should be explicit on that.
Just wonder if we're opening up a broader question if we go there. Patrina, did you want to come?
Yes.
I just want to add some comments, and before I say them, that clearly these are my personal views, because I do think that this aspect kind of goes beyond the question asked in the analysis. But at least for me personally, and almost the difficulty I see, Carson, in addressing it just seems so left field. And the reason for me it seems so left field is that the definition of cash equivalent in IS 7, by definition, they have to be investments, short-term, highly liquid investments. And then even if you look at IS1, because this is a presentation issue, IS1 actually distinguishes then between receivables and cash equivalents, because in paragraph 54, it says, you know, you must present separately, you know, the different line items that requires to be presented separately on the balance sheet is trade and other receivables, you know, separate from cash and cash equivalents. So those things to me say that receivables are different from cash and cash equivalents, you know, by definition, because they're separated in that paragraph 54. That to me, using the words of IS1, is saying the you know, the nature of those different assets are, you know, sufficiently different to warrant separate presentation.
Yeah. Can I just
that's a personal view, but yeah. So I'm agreeing with what you say. I just think it's almost so left field. I don't really see a way of addressing it.
Maybe that's within this. Yeah. So I was just wondering, Petrina, maybe that's a way to address it. I mean, just to say that, you know, there's no investment and therefore, right, kind of that might be a way to address. I think the argument why people might still consider this to be a cash equivalent or present it as a cash equivalent is that they might say, well, it is a receivable, maybe even a trade receivable, but it also meets the definition of a cash equivalent. Investment isn't defined in IS7, so that's my concern. I worry a little bit that, you know, we may leave that door open, and if we all think it's not appropriate, maybe we should be clear. That's my worry.
I just wonder if it's one to deal with in, you know, sort of on the fly if you were not analysed in the paper, because it's a broader question, I think, than just in this fact pattern. But
Yeah.
Okay, Goro, I think you were next.
Thank you, Sue. Like others, I agree with the staff's analysis and conclusion, and I expect the explanation in the agenda decision will help consistent application of the IFR standards, reducing the diversity impacts. That said, I just want to clarify one thing. In the paragraph 36 and the tentative agenda decision, there is a sentence which says, determining the date on which the entities contract your rights and would therefore depend on the specific facts and circumstances, including the applicable laws and the regulations and the characteristics of the electronic transfer system. Even if it is a legal matter and would therefore depending on specific facts and circumstances, I believe the specific electronic transfer system in a certain jurisdiction, such as the BAX payment system in the UK, the same or regulation system in a certain jurisdiction, the facts and circumstances around the transaction should be the same, which means the different entities using the same transfer system is likely to end up with the same or at least fairly similar accounting for transaction. I want to clarify this sentence does not mean to imply to allow flexibility or diversity in accounting for the same transaction depending upon the prepared judgment. As far as the facts, because it appears to be very important for the financial statement users from the comparability point of view. Thank you.
Can I ask it to the Paplina?
Yes, please. Sorry, were cutting out.
You were cutting out and I didn't catch your question, so sorry. Could you repeat, please?
Very sorry. Okay. Yeah. The thing is that in the paragraph 36 and the tentative agenda decision, there is a sentence which say that the determining blah 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 is a legal matter and therefore etc. I want to confirm. I want to confirm that
Sorry, we're not hearing.
I think you had.
I understand your question now, I think, Goro. I heard part of it before. So putting the two pieces of the jigsaw together, you were basically asking asking whether paragraph 36 and the equivalent to the agenda decision is implying that we think it would be fine to end up with different accounting for the same facts and circumstances. And I think the answer is the expectation would be that it's different facts and circumstances and different legal criteria that should give rise to different outcomes, yeah, as opposed to just different decisions being made by somebody applying our standards. I think that's the intention, that there can be legal differences that cause differences in outcomes. That's the point that we're trying to emphasize.
Yeah, thank you very much. I understand that the different legal environment will end up with a different accounting, but as far as the legal environment and the regulations are the same or very similar, that I want to confirm that preparers should, the different preparers are likely to end up with a similar.
Likely to, yes, accounting. Of course. There's always judgment, but that would be the expectation.
But if you're in the same legal position, then you should end up with the same outcome.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I think it's Brian next and then Mary. So, Brian?
Thanks, Sue. Like others, I thought this was a very good paper and it really helped me sort out my own thinking about these particular types of transfers. I'm very supportive of the analysis and of the conclusion. I just wanted to make an observation about other fact patterns, because I think I heard Paul say that you would analyse the fact patterns in the same way, and I've seen some echoes of that in the chat. I think I probably would analyse the fact patterns in the same way. Obviously, whether or not I get to the same answer is a different matter. You know, I'm aware that there is diversity in practice around presentation of some types of credit card receivables. As the submission notes, there is a similar question in relation to, unpresented checks and very basic accounting 101 questions about bank reconciliations and things like that. And I just wanted to say that I think the logic in the paper is very, very persuasive. And I would certainly apply the logic to other type patterns, but I wouldn't automatically think I would get to the same, typically, conclusion in those other fact patterns without looking at their specifics and circumstances. So for me, this is a helpful analysis, it's a useful agenda decision about the specific fact pattern addressed.
Yeah, that's fair. It's a useful framework. That could be a relevant framework to use in other circumstances, yes.
Indeed.
Mary?
I just wanted to flag, as I reflected on comments that particularly Karsten and John made, maybe some concerns about whether people would hardwire the derecognition of the receivable to the recognition of cash. I think the staff's proposed wording, tentative agenda decision proposal, the two paragraphs on page 16, halfway down under recognition of cash or another financial asset, are, I think, therefore important for addressing that concern. And Karsten, when you I think Sue's concern about doing something on the fly is a valid concern, because you're really asking for more interpretation around when are certain items appropriately considered cash or cash equivalent. But I think that you should take some comfort from these two paragraphs because it is making the point that you have to think, when you reach the conclusion that you're derecognizing the receivable, you have to think, what right do you have? And the fact that the agenda decision spells out consideration of that extra step is, I think, a very useful kind of quality check on the discipline of the agenda decision. So it was just an observation that, keeping with the theme of today, although it seems a bit of a pedantic piece of analysis, I think it's actually quite important and useful.
Thank you for that, Mary. Okay, so next thing I'm going to do is get a show of hands from committee members on whether you agree with the staff's recommendation not to add a standard setting project to the work plan. Then assuming that you agree with that, I'll ask whether anybody's got any more comments on the draft wording. So a show of hands, please, supporting not adding to the standard setting agenda.
I'm seeing everyone on screen.
Okay, and on the phone, Brian?
Yep, I agree.
And Renata?
I agree.
Thank you very much. Okay, so with that, does anybody else have any comments they want to make on the wording and the proposed tentative agenda decision before I hand over to Petrina to reflect anything she's already heard? If you could let me know. Sophie.
Yes, I have a small comment, page 16 in the second paragraph, and it relates to the second sentence starting by the committee, however expect. In fact, in the first sentence, the paragraph, we see it is written that the date of the recognition would depend on the specific facts and circumstances. But reading the fact pattern, I believe that there is no explicit and obvious evidence that the date of the recognition is the date the cash is received in the bank account. So I would suggest to amend a bit the second sentence by starting with, in the fact pattern described in the request, the committee expects that an entity would typically recognize the trade receivable on the transfer settlement date. With a bracket, assuming the entity's contractual right to receive cash from the customer to expire when the entity receives that cash and not before. In order to be more nuanced and to show that in the fact pattern it was not obvious.
Thank you, Sophie. Lisa?
So I have a comment, actually, and I, based on the feedback in the comments so far, I think it's probably most committee members might not agree with it, but it deals with on page 16 in that last paragraph, where it says, the committee observed that if an entity's contractual rights, the cash flows from the trade receivable expire before the transfer settlement date, the entity would recognize any... It kind of goes on here, but my point is that I would propose that we delete this entire paragraph. I actually find it to be confusing, and I think that it could be misinterpreted and applied in ways with stakeholders that it wasn't intended to. Because when I read this, I questioned where would there ever be a situation, and what would it be that from the time that, if you look at the fact pattern in the submission, from day zero to day two, that receivable would somehow expire, that this would actually apply. I think that we could be probably clearer somehow, maybe in the paragraph above, to say that either it's when the cash is received and it's settled, or you receive another financial asset, that is when you would de-recognize the trade receivable. And then I do find, and the reason why that's why I said just maybe deleting the whole paragraph, is I do find that last sentence when I read it to be slightly confusing, because it is like, is there some other meaning behind this? Because of course, if I'm going to recognize cash, then I have to de-recognize something else. So I thought that it says an entity would not, however, recognize cash or another financial asset received as settlement for trade receivable before it de-recognizes the trade receivable. And I just thought that was just kind of obvious.
I think at least some of your fellow committee members probably quite like this paragraph, given some of their earlier comments.
I know,
which is why you flagged that.
I acknowledge controversial comment, but I did want to at least express that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. It's good that we've got candid exchange of views. Brian, I think you're next.
Yes, so I was going to make a separate comment, but before I do that, personally, I wasn't offended by Lisa's suggestion. In the background, I've been playing around with that paragraph because I had a nagging doubt with it, and Lisa's very bold suggestion to just delete it, I found quite interesting. I actually had a much more minor comment of my own to make, and it's just about consistency of wording throughout the agenda decision. So on page 15, in the very middle of the page, the description of the request, which is about an NCTC recognizing the trade receivable and recognizing cash, if I compare that to the very final paragraph on page 17, an adequate basis for an entity to determine when to recognize a financial asset, my very small amendment would be to change financial asset there to trade receivable to echo the question that's been addressed.
Thank you, Brian. Karen.
Yeah, my comment might be similar to Sophie's. On page 16, the second paragraph under derecognition of the trade receivable, the final sentence, I'm wondering if it could be more grounded in the facts, because it uses the word expects a couple of times. The committee expects an entity would do this and it would expect this. So I don't know whether it would be more neutral to use words like, you know, observes that, you know, because the contractual, you know, because the rights haven't expired or there's no legal evidence. I would like to try to see if that final sentence could be more grounded in the assumed facts than just an expectation.
Okay, thank you. CJ.
Thank you. So I would actually agree with Lisa on page 16, that last paragraph. For the specific fact pattern we are analyzing, this last paragraph of page 16 can probably be done away with. I think the previous para, the conclusion is quite adequate.
All right. Thank you. Katrina, I'm going to to be lazy and hand over to you to comment on that, including the thoughts on that paragraph that a couple of people have referenced.
Yes, I'll walk through and I'll look at my colleagues, Sam and Gustavo and Rihanna, if they want to add to anything I say. So maybe to start with, again, Karsten, I'm sorry, I sound like I'm being mean to you each time, but I'm just going to say that I, at least at the moment, I can't see any way of addressing the cash equivalent comments that we had earlier. It's just outside the scope of this. I think the first suggestion then we had, again, I'm going sort of in order, looking page 15 and then into page 16. The first suggestion we had was about the last sentence sort of in the middle of the page just before the heading of recognition of cash. And so both Karen and Sophie had suggestions there. And I'll just explain. We obviously, I think, Donna, it was you pointed to the paragraph in the paper, I think it's paragraph 37, where we as staff in the paper were noting our expectation that typically... obviously, what we did here in Appendix A was put that in the words of the committee. So quite rightly, I think Karen and Sophie are raising the point that if you as the committee and the committee members are not comfortable with that expectation being put, you know, in your mouths, in a sense, you must decide to change that. So I suppose the question on the table is, I think the suggestion is, we have worded that again as saying the committee expects and typically... So to not say it's always typically, but to the extent, I think Karen and Sophie's points were that you'd prefer that not to be a committee expectation, but more keep it factual. And so I think we could make it factual by making this more, you know, including an if or an assuming. So we could make it more factual to say the entity would derecognize on that date, you know, if the rights, you know, expires when it receives the cash. So that would make it, you know, or assuming the rights expire when the cash is received. So we could take out expectation and just make it a factual. Mm-hmm. It would derecognize on that date if its rights expire on that date. Then we had the discussion about the last paragraph on page 16. I'm going to put words in your mouth, John, and you can shout if you disagree, that I think based on the comments you made on the paper overall, I would think that last paragraph in that page is pretty important to you, because that's the paragraph that acknowledges that there could be, you know, a time difference between when you derecognize the trade receivable and when you recognize the cash. And therefore, there could be depending on how the system works, a sort of a receivable from an intermediary party. So I would think keeping that paragraph is important for John. For me personally, we had it in there because we thought it is a possibility based on the fact pattern we explained. So I think our starting point would be to suggest we keep that paragraph, but I know Lisa and Vijay was suggesting removing it. And then finally, on the very last paragraph on page 17, we had Brian's suggestion to talk about derecognizing a trade receivable as opposed to a financial asset.
Okay, so I propose that I ask for a show of hands from the committee members on whether you support the tentative agenda decision. I'm going to say retaining the paragraph at the on the last paragraph on page 16. Could I get a show of hands for that, please?
Goro, are you voting for? Yeah, Goro's voting for. I'm seeing everyone on screen. Yes, everyone okay. On screen.
And online, Renata?
I couldn't get the question, so would you please repeat?
Do you support the tentative agenda decision with the minor changes proposed?
Yes, I support the minor changes proposed.
Thank you. And Brian?
I support the agenda decision, actually with and without the paragraph at the bottom of page 16.
Excellent. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so that brings us to the end of paper 6. So well done, Sam.
Thank you.
Okay, so now we're going to move on to our work in progress paper.
Yes.
Agenda paper 7.
Okay.